Chapter 30. Ah, at 15, poor child, thy fate was terrible. Go to. It is not good to love me, friend. They prosper not who do. I divine you. You need not say what you are thinking. In truth, I was thinking, if girls fall in love with this sallow, hook-nosed, glass-eyed, wooden-legged, dirty, hideous old man, with the sham teeth, they have a queer taste. That is what I was thinking. Jack Wilkes said the handsomest man in London had but half an hour's start of him. And, without vanity, I am scarcely uglier than Jack Wilkes. We were members of the same club at Meadenham Abbey, Jack and I, and had many a merry night together. Well, sir, I Mary of Scotland knew me, but as a little hunchback music master, and yet, I think she was not indifferent to her David Riz and she came to misfortune. They all do. Sir, you are wandering from your point, I said, with some severity. For, really, for this old humbug to hint that he had been the baboon who frightened the club at Meadenham, that he had been in the Inquisition at Valladolid, that under the name of Diriz, as he called it, he had known the lovely Queen of Scots was a little too much. Sir, then I said, you were speaking about a Miss Bechamel. I really have not time to hear all of your biography. Faith, the good wine gets into my head. I should think so, the old toper. Four bottles all but two glasses. To return to poor Blanche. As I sat laughing, joking with her, she let slip a word, a little word, which filled me with dismay. Someone had told her a part of the secret which has been divulged scarce thrice in 3,000 years, the secret of the Freemasons. Do you know what happens to those uninitiate who learn that secret? To those wretched men, the initiate who reveal it? As Pinto spoke to me, he looked through and through me with his horrible piercing glance, so that I sat quite uneasily on my bench. He continued. Did I question her awake? I knew she would lie to me. Poor child! I loved her no less, because I did not believe a word she said. I loved her blue eye, her golden hair, her delicious voice, that was true in song, though when she spoke, false as Eblis. You are aware that I possess in rather a remarkable degree what we have agreed to call the mesmeric power. I set the unhappy girl to sleep. Then she was obliged to tell me all. It was as I had surmised. Gobi de Mauchi, my wretched, besotted miserable secretary, in his visits to the chateau of the Marquis de Bechamel, who was one of our society, had seen Blanche. I suppose it was because she had been warned that he was worthless, and poor, artful and a coward, she loved him. She wormed out of the besotted wretch the secrets of our order. Did he tell you the number one? ? I asked. She said, yes. ? I further inquired. Tell you the ? Oh, don't ask me. ? She said, writhing on the sofa, where she lay in the presence of the Marquis de Bechamel, her most unhappy father. Poor Bechamel. How pale he looked as I spoke. Did he tell you, ? I repeated with a dreadful calm, the number two? ? She said, yes. The poor old Marquis rose up, and clasping his hands, fell on his knees before Count Cagba. I went by a different name then. That's in a name? That which ye call a Rosicrucian by any other name will smell as sweet. Monsieur, he said, I am old, I am rich. I have 500,000 livres of rents in Picardy. I have half as much in Artois. I have 280,000 on the Grand Liver. I am promised by my sovereign a dukedom, and his orders with a reversion to my heir. I am a grandee of Spain of the first class, and Duke of Valavento. Take my titles, my ready money, my life, my honor, everything I have in the world, but don't ask the third question. Godfroy de Bouillon. Comte de Bechamel, Grandee of Spain and Prince of Valavento, in our assembly what was the oath you swore? ? The old man writhed as he remembered its terrific purport. Though my heart was racked with agony, and I would have died, I cheerfully died, indeed, as if that were a penalty. To spare yonder lovely child a pang, I said to her calmly, Blanche de Bechamel, did Goby de Mouchy tell you secret number 3? ... she whispered a owl that was quite faint, faint and small. But her poor father fell in convulsions at her feet. She died suddenly that night. Did I not tell you those I love come to no good? When General Bonaparte crossed the Saint Bernard, he saw in the convent an old monk with a white beard, wandering about the corridors, cheerful and rather stout, but mad as a March hare. General, I said to him, did you ever see that face before? He had not. He had not mingled much with the higher classes of our society before the revolution. I knew the poor old man well enough. He was the last of a noble race, and I loved his child. And did she die by man? Did I say so? Do I whisper the secrets of the Vengerict? I say she died that night. And he, the heartless, the villain, the betrayer, you saw him seated in yonder curiosity shop, by yonder guillotine, with his scoundrelly head in his lap. You saw how slight that instrument was? It was one of the first which Guillotin made, and which he showed to private friends in a hangar in the Rue Picpus, where he lived. The invention created some little conversation among scientific men at the time, though I remember a machine in Edinburgh of a very similar construction, 200 well, many years ago, and at a breakfast which Guillotin gave he showed us the instrument, and much talk arose among us, as to whether people suffered under it. And now I must tell you, what befell the traitor who had caused all this suffering. Did he know that the poor child's death was a sentence? He felt a cowardly satisfaction, that with her was gone the secret of his treason. Then he began to doubt. I had means to penetrate all his thoughts, as well as to know his acts. Then he became a slave to a horrible fear. He fled in abject terror to a convent. They still existed in Paris, and behind the walls of Jacobins the wretch thought himself secure. Poor fool! I had but to set one of my somnambulists to sleep. Her spirit went forth, and spied the shuddering wretch in his cell. She described the street, the gate, the convent, the very dress which he wore, and which you saw today. And now this is what happened. In his chamber in the Rue Saint-Honoré, at Paris, sat a man alone, a man who has been maligned, a man who has been called a knave and charlatan, a man who has been persecuted even to the death, it is said, in Roman Inquisitions, forsooth, and elsewhere. Ha! Ha! A man who has a mighty will. And looking toward the Jacobins' convent of which, from his chamber, he could see the spires and trees, this man willed. And it was not yet dawn. And he willed, and one who was lying in his cell in the convent of Jacobins, awake and shuddering with terror for a crime which he had committed, fell asleep. But though he was asleep his eyes were open. And after tossing and writhing, and clinging to the pallet, and saying no, I will not go, he rose up, and donned his clothes a grey coat, a vest of white peak, black satin small clothes, ribbed silk stockings, and a white stock with a steel buckle, and he arranged his hair, and he tied his queue, all the while being in that strange somnolence which walks, which moves, which flies sometimes, which sees, which is indifferent to pain, which obeys. And he put on his hat, and he went forth from his cell. And though the dawn was not yet, he trod the corridors as seeing them. And he passed into the cloister, and then into the garden, where lie the ancient dead. And he came to the wicket, which Brother Jerome was opening just at the dawning. And the crowd was already waiting with their cans, and bowls to receive the alms of the good brethren. And he passed through the crowd, and went on his way, and the few people then abroad who marked him, said, Teens, how very odd he looks. He looks like a man walking in his sleep. This was said by various persons. By milk women, with their cans and carts, coming into the town. by roisterers who had been drinking at the taverns of the barrier, for it was mid-Lent. By the sergeants of the watch, who eyed him sternly as he passed near their halberds. But he passed on unmoved by their halberds, unmoved by the cries of the roisterers, by the market women coming with their milk and eggs. He walked through the Rue Saint-Honor, I say, by the Rue Rambuteau, by the Rue Saint-Antoine, by the King's Chateau of the Bastille, by the Faubourg Saint-Antoine. And he came to number 29 in the Rue Picpusset house which then stood between a court and garden, that is, there was a building of one story, with a great coach door. Then there was a court, around which were stables, coach houses, offices. Then there was a house, a two-storied house, with a perron in front. Behind the house, was a garden of 250 French feet in length. And as 100 feet of France equal 106 feet of England, this garden, my friend, equaled exactly 265 feet of British measure. In the center of the garden, was a fountain and a statue, or, to speak more correctly, two statues. One was recumbent, a man. Over him, saber in hand, stood a woman. The man was Oliphants. The woman was Judith. From the head, from the trunk, the water gushed. It was the taste of the doctor. Was it not a droll of taste? At the end of the garden, was the doctor's cabinet of study. My faith, a singular cabinet, and singular pictures. Decapitation of Charles Premier at Vidal. Decapitation of Montrose at Edinburgh. Decapitation of Cinq-Mars. When I tell you that he was a man of taste, charming. Through this garden, by these statues, up these stairs, went the pale figure of him who, the porter said, knew the way of the house. He did. Turning neither right nor left, he seemed to walk through the statues, the obstacles, the flower beds, the stairs, the door, the tables, the chairs. In the corner of the room was that instrument, which Guillotin had just invented and perfected. One day he was to lay his own head under his own axe. Peace be to his name. With him I deal not. In a frame of mahogany, neatly worked, was a board with a half circle in it, over which another board fitted. Above was a heavy axe, which fell you know how. It was held up by a rope, and when this rope was untied, or cut, the steel fell. To the story which I now have to relate, you may give credence, or not, as you will. The sleeping man went up to that instrument. He laid his head in it, asleep. Asleep? He then took a little penknife out of the pocket of his white dimity waistcoat. He cut the rope asleep. The axe descended on the head of the traitor and villain. The notch in it was made by the steel buckle of his stock, which was cut through. A strange legend has got abroad, that after the deed was done, the figure rose, took the head from the basket, walked forth through the garden, and by the screaming porters at the gate, and went and laid itself down at the morgue. But for this, I will not vouch. Only of this be sure. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamed of in your philosophy. Apostrophe more and more the light peeps through the chinks. Soon, amidst music ravishing, the curtain will rise, and the glorious scene be displayed. Adieu. Remember me. Ha! 'Tis dawn, Pinto said. And he was gone. I am ashamed to say that my first movement was to clutch the check which he had left with me, and which I was determined to present the very moment the bank opened. I know the importance of these things, and that men change their minds sometimes. I sprang through the streets to the great banking house of Manassa in Duke Street. It seemed to me as if I actually flew as I walked. As the clock struck 10, I was at the counter and laid down my check. The gentleman who received it, who was one of the Hebrew persuasion, as were the other 200 clerks of the establishment, having looked at the draft with terror in his countenance, then looked at me, then called to himself two of his fellow clerks, and queer it was to see all their aquiline beaks over the paper. Come, come, said I, don't keep me here all day. Hand me over the money, short, if you please. For I was, you see, a little alarmed, and so determined to assume some extra bluster. Will you have the kindness to step into the parlor to the partners? The clerk said, and I followed him. What, again? Shrieked a bald-headed, red-whiskered gentleman, whom I knew to be Mr. Manasseh. Mr. Salathiel, this is too bad. Leave me with this gentleman, S. And the clerk disappeared. Sir, he said, I know how you came by this. The Count de Pinto gave it you. It is too bad. I honor my parents, I honor their parents, I honor their bills. But this one of Grandma's is too bad it is, upon my word, now. She's been dead these 35 years. And this last 4 months she has left her burial place, and took to drawing on our house. It's too bad, Grandma, it is too bad. And he appealed to me, and tears actually trickled down his nose. Is it the Countess Sidonia's check or not? I asked, haughtily. But, I tell you, she's dead. It's a shame. It's a shame. It is, Grandmama. And he cried, and wiped his great nose in his yellow pocket handkerchief. Look here, will you take pounds instead of guineas? She's dead, I tell you. It's no go. Take the pounds. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.